Welcome to episode 31. As we mentioned last week, this is a special episode where we'll be really focusing on summer movies. Sam and I are going to break down all the big flicks to look forward to this year at the box office, because I'm sure if you're anything like us, you'll be spending... Well, if you're anything like me, you don't actually have air conditioning in your apartment, and thus you have to escape to air-conditioned movie theaters because you're too cheap to pay for a decent apartment. Anyway, we'll also be talking about Looney Tunes with the second part of our series Spotlight on the classic Looney Tunes cartoons. I'm Stephen Keller.
And I'm Sam Stoddard, and we're not doing our usual segments of the trivia question of the top six, and I kind of missed that, so I'm just going to improvise a trivia question right here, right now. All right, Stephen, what is the Tim Burton movie that had a script?
Okay, Tim Burton movie that had a script. Let's see, it's not Batman, not Pee-wee's Big Adventure, certainly not the Planet of the Apes remake. Ed Wood?
It is Ed Wood. That is the correct answer. Interesting about Tim Burton, you know, all the other movies had, instead of using a script, they just had a packet of papers with the dialogue and the stage directions on it, and they used that instead. But no actual script.
I assumed he always used simply storyboards, and that was all he cared about. Just told the actors to go with it.
So let's kick this party off. We got a summer preview talking about the movies that'll be coming out over the next 3 months or so, starting with... Steven, I know this is what you're looking most forward to out of the whole summer, Spider-Man 3, which opens May 4th. What do you think about Spider-Man now?
Well,
just tell us again, because we didn't get enough of that.
Yeah, I don't like the first two movies. I think we've been over that enough. But I'll tell you, the trailers for Spider-Man 3 make it look kind of appealing. I'm thinking that... I'm not going to get suckered again. I am curious, though, how many villains does this film have? All right, we've got Venom, we've got the Sandman, and we've got the Green Goblin 2. That seems like a whole lot of villains in addition to the whole Peter Parker, Mary Jane subplot stuff. It seems like maybe they're stretching a little too much. I don't know, I'm getting kind of the shade of Batman and Robin kind of thing going on here.
Yeah, the Batman series kind of did that, didn't it? Each movie had at least one, maybe two extra characters, and they never dropped any. If they dropped one, they would replace it with two more. And that just didn't work. That whole scheme failed entirely. Then again, I don't know, I thought Batman Begins, which I don't really consider part of the earlier series, but that had a number of different characters in it, too. Not Batman and Robin numbers, but it still, but that worked really well. So maybe you can do it, but I don't know if I trust the Spider-Man series not to get distracted and too shallow. Because that's the problem. You're a little too superficial if you're spreading the wealth across different characters. I don't know. For me, I didn't like the first one that much. I really like the second. But for this one, I don't know. It's tough to tell from the trailer because I don't think it looks all that great. It looks like it has promise, but that's kind of what I thought about the Superman 2 trailer, too, is it didn't really look like it was going to be... a great movie, but then I ended up at least liking it a lot.
I'm just kind of interested. I think the Venom metaphor, the evil Spider-Man that Peter Parker can be corrupted by, is always kind of an interesting thing that you can do stuff with. I think Raimi is a good choice for it, but yeah, I just can't figure out what the heck Sandman's doing in that movie. It seems like it's crowded enough without a guy made of sand. Like, come on.
I agree with you, but you know what's funny is that this movie is mirroring Superman 3 awfully closely. Okay, we got a third part of a superhero series. The third movie deals with his darker side and kind of turning into his darker side with, I don't know, this time his Venom, before it was Red Kryptonite or something like that. And now we also are splitting away from the traditional love interest. We got Mary Jane or Lois Lane. Now we're going to split away and kind of have some tension with another woman. And there's a number of other parallels, actually, quite a few.
Wait, there's another woman in this movie?
Yeah.
Is Gwen Stacy in it?
Yes, Gwen Stacy is in this
movie. I didn't
movie,
even know
so
that.
That's another character you didn't even anticipate.
So how many people are in this damn movie? there's so many people that... Wow, yeah.
Yeah, Gwen Stacy is played by...
Bryce Dallas Howard.
Bryce Dallas Howard, yep. Yep. Which is interesting casting, I think.
That's, how long is this movie, like 6 hours long?
Well, it probably is quite long, actually.
Yeah, I guess it'd have to be.
Yeah, well, okay. Well, if you're not into Spider-Man, if you're one of the few people like Steven or half me, then maybe you'll want to see instead on May 4th Lucky You, which is a movie directed by Curtis Hanson. His past work is things like 8 Mile and L.A. Confidential, Wonder Boys, quite a varied resume, really. But it's kind of a comedy-drama set in the world of poker. We have Eric Bana, and he wants to be a poker champion, but his personal life, he's kind of wrestling with at the same time. Drew Barrymore is his girlfriend, and Robert Duvall is his father, who also plays poker. What do you think about this? Have you seen trailers for it?
Yeah, I'm not that interested. I mean,
it doesn't really feel like the Poker's movie that Rounders is, right?
No, it sure doesn't. Also, I hate Drew Barrymore, so it's like a romantic comedy where Drew Barrymore is enough to keep me out.
All right, well, I'm gonna keep an open mind about that one. I think it'd go either way. Let's move on. On May 11th, there's a movie called 28 Weeks Later. If that's familiar, it's because it's the sequel to 28 Days Later.
Which was itself a sequel to 28 Days.
Right. Sandra Bullock finally got out of rehab, and it turns out the world is overrun with zombies. So it's a terrible, kind of ironic twist to that story. Oh, did you like 28 Days Later?
No. I did not. I know I like Danny Boyle,
okay,
but I don't like that movie. I kind of think it has an interesting look to it for a zombie movie, but otherwise I'm not that into it. It's kind of retarded, but yeah. Hey, I like the title, 28 Weeks Later. That's pretty clever. Otherwise, no, not that interested.
I can't wait for 28 years later and everybody's in old makeup.
That'll be great. All the zombies have walkers.
Yeah, that's a good idea. All right, well, let's skip down to Shrek the Third on May 18th. That's when it opens. Shrek the Third, gosh. The trailer looks like it has lots of babies throwing up in people's faces, lots of Eddie Murphy doing weird things, and that's pretty much what these movies are built on, I guess. The first one, actually, I thought it did a good job at taking a fairy tale world and taking all the different characters from well-known fairy tales and mixing it up in kind of a crazy world and actually taking the cliches seriously and getting some humor out of that. What do you think? Has the series lost that direction since then, or what?
Yeah, lost that for me around Shrek 2, which I didn't really like that much.
Okay.
I don't know. I feel like 1 was really enough that... The Shrek series just seems to me got too many like excesses, too many like random pop culture references that don't really fit in that well, and too much just kind of silly humor. I don't know. You know, it kind of reminds me of that other Michael Myers franchise, the Austin Powers series, where I feel like the first film was kind of, you know, a little focused, and like it or not, you know, it did really kind of have a specific focus. It was going to mock that James Bond kind of thing. And then as the series goes on, they just kind of like add in more and more random pop culture references for no real reason. And I feel that's kind of what's going on with the Shrek series.
That's kind of what happened to the Zucker Brothers and Jim Abraham's comedies. You know, you got Airplane and The Naked Gun, and then eventually that style of humor was all about referencing the current movies and forgetting the punchlines. You know,
right.
Just do it. Like in Shrek 2, it had a Matrix-style fight scene, and I noticed the trailer for Shrek 3 has the Kill Bill, you know, the Twisted Nerve music and somebody suiting up to go out on it.
Right.
You know, I don't really understand that. And the thing is, I laugh at it too, though, so... But I like Shrek 2, actually.
Yeah, it just doesn't seem that satisfying. It's like, they're kind of funny in the moment, but it's not something you ever, like, think about and call back to. It's not like the better parts of Naked Gun.
That's what it is, yeah.
Hilarious.
Yeah, that's probably what it is. It's longevity that they're losing there. All right, well, a week later, we're going to talk about another controversial take, little tidbit here. Pirates of the Caribbean at World's End. Why don't you give us your rant about Pirates of the Caribbean? Because we don't get that enough.
Well, I don't know if it's a rant so much as I'm just not that into these movies. Like, I like them, kind of. I just don't get all the people who just love it. I mean, especially the first one. I never understood that at all. I just thought it wasn't that interesting at all. This movie, though, looks kind of like more of the same. I like the first one and the second one equally, I think. And a lot of people thought the second one was much weaker. I gotta say, I'm gonna go see this movie. I'm sure I'll wait in line with everyone else on the planet to go watch this movie when it opens, and I'll probably be like, oh, okay, that was about what I expected. I'm just so glad to see Jeffrey Rush back, because boy, was he missing from the second film.
Yeah.
If somehow they get rid of Mr. and Mrs. Cardboard and it's just all Johnny Depp and all Jeffrey Rush, I would be ecstatic. And maybe they get rid of that damn monkey, because I find the thing really irritating.
All right, well, I'm what you describe as a lot of people. I love the first movie. I thought it was a great adventure, seagoing kind of thing, the right tones and everything. The second movie I also liked, but it just seemed too self-conscious, like a lot of sequels do. They figure out what worked, what people liked about it, and then they set about to write a sequel that purposely accentuates those qualities. And when you accentuate them and you're self-conscious about it, I don't think it works as well. So basically, we had the first movie. It was great. Second movie, we get Johnny Depp, 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 and fighting on a water wheel and whatever that thing was. And too much, too much. It's just simmer down, like calm down and have a moment to like gather. And that's kind of what I thought about the second one. But the third one, I think you're right. I think Jeffrey Rush was the missing ingredient in terms of the flavor. I think it was still going to be overdone, the second one, but in terms of the flavor and the color in the movie, the things you could really latch onto and say, "Hey, this is the kind of scenery chewing I watch these movies for." Jeffrey Rush's character is, I think, a real important ingredient to these movies, and I also think the trailers show a new character, Ken Watanabe, as a really kind of edgy pirate character, and that looks really interesting.
Yeah, but again, I worry that maybe this movie, these are already pretty crowded movies. I worry that, adding in a whole another big character is gonna make it even more tough for it to. But again, if it means less screen time for Orlando Bloom, I'm all for it.
Oh, yeah, I don't understand the appeal there of him. He made a great elf. What's he doing in other things? Oh, well, we just alienated our entire female audience.
Hey, I suffered through Elizabethtown. I've seen enough Orlando Bloom for the last a lifetime.
Right, well, moving on to June 1st. It's a weird one. Flatland the movie. You might not have heard this one. They haven't really started advertising it yet. If you know the book Flatland, it's kind of a slim novel, an easy read, but it's a speculative thing about what it would be like to live in a two-dimensional world, and all the people in it would be things like squares and circles and triangles and stuff. And you can only see their edges because you live in the two-dimensional world. You can't go outside the world and look down on it to so you get a clear view. And so the book speculates on what it's like to have a society in this kind of world. And it's all very silly, of course, but it's such an interesting perspective and it's well thought out that it's just a really interesting book. Now, how they make that into a movie, because the book doesn't really have a story you could latch on to and make a movie out of it, I don't think. I don't even know how they'd show it visually. Again, you'd have we talk about widescreen. This would be like infinity to one aspect ratio if you do this faithfully. What are they doing with this?
Yeah, I mean, the book is really a satire on the social situation of England at the time in the late 19th century. So I'm not sure how that's going to translate into a 21st century film. I mean, are they going to bother keeping all that? Will it make any sense to most people? Will they be interested in it? I just don't. I mean, yeah, Flatland's kind of a classic, especially among geeks who are interested in the way that they really deal with different dimensions and stuff, but I can't really see this working as a film at all. What a screwy novel to try and adapt.
Yeah, well, at least it's not just more talking animals, so that's a point for originality. So, also on June 1st, if you're not into squares, then maybe you want to watch Mr. Brooks, which is a thriller with Kevin Costner. He's got an alter ego played by William Hurt and makes him kill people. Otherwise, he's a kind of a normal guy. And the detective on the case is Demi Moore.
Ugh.
Yeah, weird casting.
Who cast Demi Moore as a detective? That's right up there with Denise Richards as a nuclear scientist, and The World Is Not Enough.
Yeah,
Ugh.
Hurt is the only one of those three stars that I like, but I don't know. Even Moore has made an occasional good movie, so I don't know. I guess the question is, does this movie really dig down into these psychological elements of the story, or is it just the gimmick to get you into this serial killer thriller?
Yeah, on some blogs, I think it was David Pullen's The Hot Blog. One of the commenters there made a comment that, does Donald Kaufman have screenwriting credit on this film because it's a ripoff of his film The Three from Adaptation? Which I really hope that it is. I hope that Demi Moore turns out to also be the same person as Kevin Costner and William Hurt. And I hope there's a scene in which motorcycles have to fight horses or something. Because it's man versus machine versus horse. Yeah, I don't know what the heck this is. This movie looks goofy.
And yet, it also looks like something that's very much in style these days, these serial killer procedural kind of deals. I guess CSI made those popular, and we just love crazy people killing people, I guess. I don't, personally.
Yeah, I
Now,
mean,
I guess, actually, now you saw one of these recently that you loved, Zodiac by David Fincher, that's just absolutely been ignored lately. Maybe
Yeah.
we'll take a break and have a word or two about that. What do you think about that?
Well, Zodiac, though, is completely different. Zodiac's completely different from all these other movies. I mean, it's based on the actual story. So, spoiler alert if you haven't been paying attention to the last 30 years, but they don't ever actually catch the guy. So it's kind of different that way. And so, the movie keeps the killer at quite a distance since there's no conclusive proof that it's anyone in particular. Unlike, most of these movies where the killer is as much a star as anyone else, this movie's really about the people who are looking for him and how it affects them over 30 years. And how can you really, like, search for something for 20 plus years? You have to be completely obsessed to do that, and that's really what it is. And well, the thing about Zodiac 2 is that I like is it gets really, really detailed about the way the cops and the reporters and stuff go about trying to solve it. It gets really detailed about that. I feel like a lot of these movies just, they listen to my How to Solve a Crime how-to guide, just go through the motions and, just set up kind of thriller elements. So, I don't know. I would prefer to see these movies if they were more detailed or depth, or if they're like Silence of the Lambs, where they just really get into the minds of the characters. Then that works. You mentioned that, well, maybe this movie will do that. Maybe it'll really get into the characters, but I doubt it.
Yeah, I kind of doubt it too. Wishful thinking on my part. I think what really turned me onto this kind of thing was before CSI, there was a show on the Discovery Channel, actually a couple shows, and maybe they're still running for all I know, that took actual cases and kind of took you through the forensic evidence that led them to whatever conclusion they came to. And because these are based on real life, sometimes they got the guys, sometimes not. But for some reason, they were able to pick really interesting stories. And so for a while, I was really addicted to that show. And when CSI came along, I thought, oh, this is cool. So it'd be like a drama version of the same sort of idea. And CSI, I mean, I loved it for a while. And then I think it's starting to repeat itself. I still watch the show, so I can't really,
Man.
I'm implicating myself by saying I do, but I at least don't watch the spin-offs too. I mean, once a week is enough.
I happened to see the CSI with David Caruso in it the other day, and I think that show consists of just 45 minutes of Caruso putting on and taking off sunglasses dramatically.
Yes.
Oh,
Yes.
so bad.
Yeah, it's really terrible. Now, there was a great episode of CSI, though, that you should have seen because it was the finale a couple of years ago where basically you're getting a full-length movie that Quentin Tarantino wrote and directed. And boy, was it fascinating to see Tarantino take his own style and his own, especially his dialogue is so distinctive. He give these Tarantino-esque monologues to characters that we've known for 4 or 5 years already. That was really crazy. But I mean, it's just story-wise and as a thriller, I think it was the best thing that I've seen on that show by far. If you can pick out that episode on a DVD release or something, could just get that one disc from Netflix or something, very much worth it. It's like getting a whole new Tarantino movie that you weren't expecting.
Yeah, I think he did that with Alias as well, another show I didn't really like that much. But I think Mr. Brooks would be a better film if Albert Brooks were playing the serial killer. I mean, how cool would that be? Albert Brooks, the serial killer? That's what I've been hoping for.
How about Mel Brooks as the guy's other identity?
Oh, yeah, that'd be a good, man, that would be a totally different film.
We call it Mr. Brooks's.
Well, we gotta write that immediately.
All right, well, let's skip down to June 8th. Get back on track here. We got, speaking of large casts, we start out with 11, and then you go to 12, and now we're up to Ocean's 13. At least, we've dropped some characters from Ocean's 12 to make room for Al Pacino as the new villain. I have to say, Al Pacino is perfect for this series, I think. And you see the previews, and he's just really, really having a great time as only Pacino can. I mean, that scenery is good and chewed. But what do you think? Is this going to be, because you loved, as I did, Ocean's 11.
Right.
And 12, you didn't like at all. I liked it, but it was a definite step down. It was sort of a borderline disposable kind of entertainment for me. All I can say is I hope that 13 gets back on track, because I couldn't take another step down. If it's as good as 12, I'll still be happy, though.
Boy, I won't be if it's anything like 12, but I saw the trailer, and I'll tell you, Al Pacino just feels like a natural for that particular little
Yeah.
world they've created there.
It feels like he's been in that world all along.
Right. Oh gosh, I'm gonna go see it for sure. I'm excited anyway. But yeah, they've dropped Julia Roberts, right, and Catherine Zeta-Jones.
I don't think either one
You
of them are
think?
in this, yeah.
Interesting. Well, okay.
It's a guy movie now.
Yeah, so Andy Garcia this time is a good guy, or not a good guy, but the guy they're working with to go after Pacino?
Yeah, that's more or
Is
less
that
the
what it
vibe
looks
I
like? I'm
get,
not
yeah.
sure. I feel like Andy Garcia's character really is the one that got shafted between Ocean's 11 and Ocean's 12. Like, I feel like he plays a totally different character in the two movies. And I hope they. Well, I don't know. Now he's like a good guy. I'm not sure how that's going to be about exactly, but well, we'll see.
Now, what was it about 12 that kind of turned you off from it?
The fact that there were no heists that we actually saw.
It was a lack of the heist. Now, I was kind of thinking about this earlier, and we did a top six a while back about distinctly different sequels, and for the most part, we admired them. We did on our fifth and sixth slots have to pick some that were just distinctly different and terrible. But for the most part, we were pretty complimentary about this idea of taking a sequel but doing something different with it. And so now in the second movie, we've got something different. Hey, it's not another heist. It is something else. So how do you respond to that?
Yeah, I mean, maybe part of it is my fault for not, I'm judging the movie that I wanted, not the movie that was made. But on the other hand, I just don't think it's. I think it's like, I don't know, just kind of 2 hours of not much. And as cool as it is to watch those characters and the charisma, it wore kind of thin on me after a little while. And I did feel that if you're going to make kind of a weirder, more film that's just sort of about characters, you need to define them a little better. And I think the large cast and kind of ended up making it difficult. In the first movie, everyone had a clear role, so you know why they were there. The second movie, I'm not really sure what half the characters were doing there. And I hated the joke about Julia Roberts' character looking just like the real Julia Roberts. That was a little too breaking the fourth wall kind of weirdness to me.
Yeah. Okay, well, I actually liked it, but no, with 12, I think the response I would give to my own question would be, well, yes, it's great if you do something different and try something else, but if you're going to take away something that worked, you have to replace it with something that worked at least as well. And the con games and stuff that happened in Ocean's 12, I think, were decent, but it's certainly nothing with the impact that that heist did in 11. So you have to do something at least that good, and I hope 13 corrects that problem and gets more into the sneaking around. It's not just a con game, it's sort of a mix of the two, and that's, I think, the appeal of the original. Well, I say the original, it's the first remake. All right, moving on. In another week after that, June 15th, we got a movie called Fantastic Four: Rise of the Silver Surfer. Now, I didn't see the original, did you?
Yes.
You didn't like it, did you?
In the theater.
What did you do that for? I knew better than that.
Yeah, well, you can ask my girlfriend
Oh, it's her
who
fault.
demanded we go and see it.
Okay. Well, we'll blame her.
Yeah, it was terrible.
Is she going to demand that you see the sequel?
No, the first one I think scarred her enough. I like how they went ahead and added a crappy character to be their big thing. Does anyone like the Silver Surfer? I mean, he's like the lamest comic book character outside of Aquaman. I mean, first of all, he was a character that was sort of created to cash in on the surfing fad of the 60s and 70s. They're like, hey, we need a surfer because that's what the kids like. And then so they made him like this weird cosmic surfing hippie, and he's always been like this lame reject of a character. I can't even imagine why he is now in a. I mean, what's next? We're gonna add Plastic Man to a major motion picture sometime soon? How desperate are we for comic book characters that the Silver Surfer is getting his name in the title of a major motion picture?
Now, was he ever a character that intersected with the Fantastic Four at all? I'm not the comic book geek, so I have to ask this
Yeah,
question.
well, you gotta remember, like, pretty much every comic book character's interacted with every other comic book character
Good
at
point,
some
good
time.
point.
Just remember, anything for a buck, that's the comic book industry motto. They are writing, comics for 13-year-olds.
All right, well, if the Fantastic Four and the Silver Surfer aren't your thing, maybe instead on June 15th you'd be in to see Nancy Drew. I think you'll be there because the Silver Surfer's not your thing. Obviously, it's going to be Nancy Drew, right?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
I gotta just complain here, because I did not grow up reading Nancy Drew, but I did grow up reading the Bobbsey Twins and the Three Investigators and the Hardy Boys and all those types of things. So I do have an affection
Oh, the Hardy
for
Boys.
that kind of children's detective fiction from that era. And Nancy Drew and the Hardy Boys right alongside each other, the same publishing company, probably the same authors. There was each of these two series were published under one pseudonym, but really there's a bunch of different authors working on both, and so it's sort of the the equivalent of the Hardy Boys for girls. And then you look at the trailer, and I thought, oh no, what are they? It's just this modern, very up-to-date high school kind of angsty thing. Everybody has a cell phone and parties, and oh. It loses the charm. I mean, does everything have to be updated to the immediate life experience of the target audience is my question. I mean, definitely producers think so, but I think the power of the movies here, and I'm getting on my anti-commercial rant here, the power of the movies is their ability to make us feel and see and experience things outside our own lives. So okay, you got these pulpy adventures with Nancy Drew that take place in the 40s or 50s, or at least have that spirit to them. It became an iconic character. Why call it Nancy Drew unless you're going to do something that's at least close to that in spirit? Crazy talk, I know, but that's a peeve of mine. I really hate to see that character messed around with, even though I never really read her.
My question is, when do we get to see an Encyclopedia Brown movie? Like, they'll present a mystery and then they'll reveal the solution at the very end after giving you some time to think about who done it. That would be a great movie.
Well, I tell you what, if this Nancy Drew movie kicks off, I'm sure you'll see that one coming around the corner.
Excellent,
No
excellent.
time.
I was wondering if he'd update his prices because I read those books well after, they were published, and it was like he charged like 25 cents a day. When I was a kid, that was like worthless, 25 cents. So I opened a new version. He's making at least $10 a day, plus expenses.
Okay. Well, we'll hope that inflation is on his side. All right, well, maybe if you're not into the Silver Surfer or Nancy Drew, you'll be seeing Evan Almighty. Because, as we mentioned before, there's this huge demand for sequels to Jim Carrey movies that don't star Jim Carrey. But, this one, though, is starring Steve Carell, who obviously is a huge star now for some reason because people think he's funny. But yeah, the guy's got fans, whether I'm one of them or not. And the studio knows that, so I think they're going to take better care of this sequel than something like, Son of the Mask or whatever. But I'm not really that interested, are you?
I didn't really like Bruce Almighty, so the second-rate sequel. And I do like Steve Carell, and I don't know, it doesn't really. It's one of those movies where it's like a kind of high concept, but then like, the execution of it is really kind of dull. It's like, okay, so you're God for a week, and the most interesting thing you can do is like teach your dog how to use a toilet or whatever. What? That's. Yeah, I don't get the appeal of that movie at all. Morgan Freeman as God is a pretty good casting decision.
All right, well, I know that you'll be lining up a couple weeks later then,
Oh yes.
especially after being starved for something to see. Why don't you kick it off?
Live Free or Die Hard. Ah, the fourth installment of my great Die Hard series. I'm really nervous that this one will suck, but gosh, I'm got my fingers crossed. I mean, maybe it'll be like a reverse Star Trek kind of thing where the odds are good and the evens aren't. So maybe Die Hard 5 will pick it up if this one's not any good. But Live Free or Die Hard. This is like a series whose titles just rock the house. I hope the movie, if it's half as good as the title, will be set. Oh, man.
This is the best title of all time, I think. Part of it's because I live in New Hampshire. That comes with a state motto, live free or die. I think it should change it now to live free or die hard, maybe.
That'd be a great promotional. That would be the best promotional stunt of all time if Fox could get New Hampshire to change its motto to the title of this film.
Now, did you see Underworld or any of those movies? Because
Oh, I hated Underworld. I didn't
that's the problem
see
here.
the sequel though.
Yeah, that's the problem because this director is the Underworld director, and that's pretty much all he's done. So I don't know about that, but the trailer looks pretty good. It seems like it's got the right spirit to it.
Yeah, I just hope that they don't bring any of that crappy MTV style to Die Hard that they had in Underworld because that would just kill me.
Yeah. Okay, well, let's see. In a couple days after that, then we get Pixar number 8. Ratatouille. And I don't think there's a reason to think that this movie is going to be the first to go wrong. I mean, Cars, some people didn't like that. I think it suffered only by comparison with the previous six Pixar movies. But we got Brad Bird back in the director's chair. He's the one that did The Incredibles, and he did The Iron Giant before that. And I thought those are two of the very best animated films of recent years. I mean, there's just so much fun. So I have to think that this one is going to pick that up, too.
Yeah, I'm excited. I liked Cars. You know, I don't like as much as you did. I actually think Bug's Life is their weakest entry. I like Cars more than Bug's Life. But yeah, Ratatouille looks really good. You know, Pixar finally gets into the talking animals game, so I mean, maybe a little nervous about that fact. But it's Brad Bird, like you said. There's no way this is gonna go wrong. I mean, I guess it could, but I'm excited.
Yeah, and, you know, talking animals isn't an inherently bad idea. It seems like that's what everybody does when they don't have any other ideas. But I don't think that the creative team at Pixar is going to run out of ideas anytime soon. All right, moving on. Let's move on to July 4th. Well, it's almost a franchise. It technically is, actually. It's the Transformers, but I was thinking the Michael Bay movie is almost a franchise of its own, and this one is directed by Michael Bay. And you know what? I can barely watch the trailer of a Michael Bay movie and not feel sick about it, honestly. I mean, that's how much I dislike his movies. I knew The Island was going to be an exception, though, a mild exception, when I saw that trailer, and my stomach did not churn, so I kind of knew that maybe...
That was just the presence of Scarlett Johansson.
No, she's great.
That's what I said. That's why your stomach didn't
churn.
Oh,
that's why my stomach churned.
Because you were soothed by Scarlett Johansson's presence.
That's a compelling theory.
Yeah, but come on, The Island sucked, dude. I don't know why you like it.
No, I liked it.
It was a good movie in comparison to Pearl Harbor, I'll grant you that.
Anything's a good movie compared to Pearl Harbor. Oh. In fact, I'm sure the Transformers will also be a good movie compared to Pearl Harbor. Pearl Harbor may be mad.
Yeah.
You know, I think it really did the veterans a real injustice, and so it just... upset me. But
yeah, I mean, look, even if you like Transformers, it's not nearly as serious a thing to ruin as as you know, an actual historic tragedy.
So you've seen the trailer for this? Is your
man? Well, first of all, look, I hate to break to everybody, I grew up in the 80s too. Transformers is a stupid idea. All right, you got these robots that transform into big rig trucks. It's not a good idea. I'm sorry, it's just dumb. It was made to sell toys. I watched the cartoon too. I remember watching the movie, the original animated film, which actually is not as terrible as it should be. But yeah, let's be honest. Transformers, there's nothing in here to really think it should be made into a great major motion picture. This is a ridiculous idea, and the movie looks equally stupid.
It was a good idea for a toy, though.
Oh, hey, of course.
Yeah.
Great toys.
All right. July 13th, a week later, maybe I think we're going to pick this up. We got Harry Potter and the Order of the Phoenix. Now, I loved all four of the Harry Potter movies so far. Thought the two most recent were better than the first two because probably better directed. I don't really think much of Chris Columbus. But the last one, number four, before I saw it, really made me nervous because it had to condense a much larger story. Very large plot-driven story, so you got to catch most of the content of it and compress it into a single movie. And I was worried about that. I kind of thought it might miss something. As it turned out, I had nothing to worry about. I loved the fourth movie almost as much as the third. But you know what? I got different types of worries about five now. I keep having a different worry each time, maybe because I'm just so paranoid that they're going to finally screw it up before they get to the end. But this time, I think it's a more serious thing. It's, gosh, why did they do this? They pick a director that has only ever really worked in television. Very untested director compared to the previous ones. Even Chris Columbus, you know, he at least knew he could make a movie and get it done in some kind of an organized fashion and not have everything go chaos. And then you talk about artistic value after that. But this, maybe he'll be brilliant. And I hope that the producers who picked him saw something in him that he has not yet shown the world. But I just have to be worried because this is a huge franchise. It's a huge job to deliver one of these movies. There's a lot of characters to do justice to, a lot of story, a lot of effects, and even just running time. There's a lot of content. So,
yeah,
I don't know. And I actually, honestly, don't think the trailer looks that good.
Well, it's a trailer for, I mean, this is like far and away the most talky of the Harry Potter story. So I don't know. I mean, this one's pretty much all characters. It really kind of... the action takes a real backseat in this movie, I think, to most of the character conflicts, at least from the story. So I think that's part of the reason why it'd be tough to sell in a trailer, period. But I feel like probably at this point in time, these movies kind of, you know, more than a director, they just need someone to manage traffic. And I think if they, you know, this Yates guy can do that, I don't think it'll be that big of a deal. I mean, if there's a solid screenplay and, you know, all the players know their parts by this point in time, so I'm not that worried about it. I feel like these are almost become like old studio movies now. It must be after five of them in such a short period of time. I have to imagine that, you know, the cast and crew have to pretty well understand how it works. I mean, the fact that there have been, you know, so far three different directors with such different styles and they produced fairly uniform movies makes me think that really there's not that. The director doesn't have a whole as much input as you might normally think in these films.
Well, those are reassuring words. And I tell you one thing, if he does come out with a great movie, that's going to look great on his resume, that's for sure. He come out of nowhere, be put in charge of this big production, and he does a good job with it. I hope that's how it works out. Well, okay, if Harry Potter isn't your thing, then... if Harry Potter's not your thing, you should probably go read the books again or for the first time and figure out what people love about it. Because honestly, I have everybody who said, Harry Potter's an infant kid. He goes to wizarding. Yeah, I don't know about that. And every person I have successfully persuaded to read the books has loved them.
Yeah, I was not into them until people convinced me to read them. I thought they looked terrible.
And even if you've just seen the movies are really good, but they're so much better if you have the books to complement them. Well, anyway, you might also want to see a second movie that weekend, and maybe it'll be 1408, which is a Stephen King adaptation with John Cusack and Samuel L. Jackson. Really interesting casting there. But what's 1408, actually? I have no idea. Do you know what that story is?
I'm not a big Stephen King fan, so I don't know what the actual story is. I've seen the trailer, though.
Okay, well, what did you think of that? Because I don't think I've seen it yet.
The premise is John Cusack plays this like paranormal investigator kind of guy who doesn't believe in ghosts. And he's like, oh, yeah, I'd really like to find a ghost, but I don't think they exist. And someone like sends him some anonymous letter or something that there's this hotel room, and the room is 1408. So it's kind of like a Shining kind of thing, almost, and supposedly haunted. And he goes there, and Samuel L. Jackson is the hotel manager who tells him, you know, no one's ever survived an hour in this room. And so it looks like it's mainly like Cusack locked in this room for an hour or something with these ghosts tormenting him. It sounds kind of terrible, but the trailer makes it look interesting, and I'm kind of intrigued with a closed room kind of horror movie starring John Cusack. That does intrigue me, but yeah, I mean, I'm a little, I don't know. Horror movies are so easy to do poorly.
Yeah, there's a lot of horror movies. A small percentage are good, and an even smaller percentage of Stephen King movies are good. I don't know what it is about his writing that people don't, the filmmakers just can't adapt it. They have a hard time doing that.
Yeah, they sure do.
Including King himself, apparently.
Yeah. You're not a big Maximum Overdrive fan? I gotcha.
And even the ones he's written the screenplay for, you know, he wrote the screenplay to, I think it was Rose Red or something, and, you know, that didn't work out either. It's just not good. Not good. There are some great ones, though. I mean, Shawshank and The Green Mile and Misery, I liked that one a lot, too. Dolores Claiborne is a good movie.
Yeah, it's all of his non-horror films that are great.
I guess that's what it is. All right, well, are you a Hairspray fan?
No, not really.
Okay.
I didn't like the original. I'm not a big John Waters fan, period.
Yeah, Hairspray. July 20th, they're going to make it. John Travolta, Amanda Bynes, Christopher Walken, Queen Latifah, and Michelle Pfeiffer in a Broadway musical. That sounds... strange.
I like the fact that John Travolta's playing a woman, though.
Yeah, I guess that's a character that's normally played by a man. So, but I'm not into the whole mythos of this show, so... I'm the wrong person to comment about this, I guess.
Right.
I'm not going to say that if I think it'll be good or not, because I'm just not one of the people it's directed to. I will, however, say that is some interesting casting. And, you know, half of them you'd expect to see in a Broadway musical, maybe, and the other half is just like, what are they doing there? I mean... you remember the days in the studio era where everybody who appeared in a movie could sing and dance and act?
Oh, yeah.
How come that happened?
I don't know, man. It's strange that it's gone away, though.
Yeah. Well, I guess there's not as much call to insert random songs and dances into every other genre. All right, moving on. We got The Simpsons Movie on July 27th, you know, after 18 seasons, right? Now, finally, we get a movie. What is it about The Simpsons that is providing so much material, or is it not that much material and it's just being stretched out?
Yeah, it's not that much material. I loved The Simpsons back when they were good. I was just saying, I think the show stopped being particularly entertaining about 10 years ago.
That long.
So, I'm not that excited about the movie, I gotta say.
Okay, well, I've heard that opinion a lot, and I'm not the big Simpsons fan you are. I've seen episodes here and there. I don't know when they were made. I've just, if there's a rerun or something, and I happen to be in the mood, then I'll watch it. And invariably, I'll enjoy it to some extent, and including ones I know were very recent. So, they're funny, but what is it that changed about 10 years ago for you?
Well, part of it is that there's none of the original writers are still even remotely associated with the show, basically. The other thing is the show went from having serious characters. I mean, there was an actual emotional arc that the characters had in a given episode. There's actual emotional investment, and it just kind of turned into just being like nonstop wackiness. It's sort of one of those, and that is okay, honestly. If I watch a recent Simpsons, a lot of times I'll get a couple of laughs out of it. But there's something like the original couple of seasons. I really think they told fairly. Series that even if they didn't feel real, they had some sort of emotional resonance. Whereas now it's more of like we talked about with that Trek 3 kind of thing, which is pop culture and goofiness without anything else. And to me, it makes them kind of forgettable and disposable versus the originals that really did make a real conscious effort to have some resonance and weight to them.
That's interesting. So maybe that explains me too, because if I just see a random episode, I'm not really thinking, gosh, they really dug into the characters better 15 years ago or whatever. I'm just astounded that the show has run so long.
Yeah, it is pretty impressive. I mean, I don't think it's ever going to end at this point.
Well, anyway, we got a movie coming out. What's funny is that there's a media frenzy about, well, what's the story of this? And it's like, well, what do you mean story? It's going to be The Simpsons. You ought to know what it's about. August 3rd, The Bourne Ultimatum. Now, Steven's going to chime in with a very different opinion in a moment, but I love these movies. And the first one significantly better than the second, though, I got to say. I think the first one sets up the second if you don't know the character. Now, see, the first one is. He has amnesia, this guy Jason Bourne, and he's trying to figure out what his life is all about. Now, that just alone, I love that idea. It's done in a lot of different movies, dating back to very early on in the history of the movies. And for some reason, every single time I find that compelling. But in this case, people are trying to kill him, and he discovers that, gosh, a reflex kicks in, and he winds up beating somebody up. And he's like, how do I know how to do that? And so that's just the first movie is a really interesting exploration, and he sort of gets involved into this spy story. It's like James Bond, but not at all like James Bond, actually, because it's not so over the top and meta jokey, that kind of thing. This is a more down-to-earth kind of gritty story. And the second movie continues on that, but we kind of lose that hook into the characters. So I think the second movie rides the momentum of the first a bit. And I'm hoping the third, which supposedly the overall story reaches a more definitive conclusion, as I understand it. So I'm hoping that in doing that, it'll get back into the character a little bit, and the middle movie will just be a typical middle movie. But honestly, I'd like it even if it were as good and no better than the second movie. So chime in with your difference of opinion here, Stephen. What do you think about Bourne?
I think the Bourne series is kind of dull and forgettable. I agree. I like the premise, but much more than that, like the set pieces never quite work. I agree, though, the first movie's definitely better than
Oh, you've
the
seen the
sequel.
first since then? Because the last time we talked about this, we.
Yeah, I seen it on cable.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, the first is okay, but I hate. I mean, this, I don't know. People tell me I need to go see United 93, and all I can think is I saw Paul Greengrass's Bourne film, and it was freaking terrible. Can't imagine he's actually a good director.
Well, I gotta tell
So,
you.
who is directing this one? Is it Greengrass again, or
Yes, it
who?
is Greengrass again, and I was actually disappointed about that because the thing about the second movie that I didn't, the things about it I didn't like, I think I can trace directly back to Greengrass. All I can say is United 93 is in a different league, but the editing in Bourne 2 was a bit off. Yeah,
Oh.
it was a little too frenetic and. Not good. We both read a column, David Pullen's column on the web, and he was saying something about how the third act of Bourne Supremacy was just an editing masterpiece. And all I could think was, What? I think he said that. Maybe I'm paraphrasing him and putting words in his mouth, but no, it's not well edited.
Well, this is David Poland we're talking about.
But other than that, I mean, I think that's really my main problem with that movie, and I thought the rest of it was really good. Well, okay, if you're not a Bourne fan, maybe you're an Underdog fan, because on August 3rd, we got an Underdog movie, one of my favorite cartoons as a kid. In recent years, turns out Underdog is just fun for kids, but regardless, there's no reason Underdog needs the kind of treatment that this trailer that is out there now. What is? Have you seen it? Oh gosh, it looks terrible.
No, what is it, like another, is it like live action or animated or?
It's a live action. It's a real dog with, the CGI to make him talk and everything. It's a real dog in a cape. And he's like, there's a scene from the trailer I remember. He's perched onto the side of the skyscraper that these criminals are trying to scale up. And he has some witty one-liner and sends them falling or something. I think Transformers makes me churn a bit less than this one. There's no reason to do this to a character. And why? Who are they marketing this to? Nobody who's heard of Underdog is going to want to see this.
Man, yeah, this is, well, it's we're getting into August now, so yeah, it's kind of when they dump movies they don't like that much.
Yeah, that's worth saying since we're talking about the summer anyway. May is usually, I think of as the biggest budget, lowest common denominator spectacles, the absolute most popular franchises, they continue in May. And then in June, you got a little bit lower key, the ones that can't really kick things off, but they can carry through in June. And then July 4th, you got another one franchise entry for the July 4th, the big July 4th weekend. And the rest of July and then into August, there's this gradual, I think, decline in the studio's confidence in the movies. And so by August is actually a really interesting time because it's not a time when the studio is going to be as confident as they are with their May and July 4th releases. But sometimes you get some real diamonds in the rough in August sometimes. And maybe one of them will be on August 10th, Rush Hour 3. Do you think that's one going to be the diamond in the rough for August?
No.
Well, that's a pretty definitive answer.
Well.
I gotta tell you, I love Jackie Chan. Chris Tucker, yeah, he's funny in small doses, but I don't know that the Rush Hour movies really deliver it, even the first one.
Yeah, I have to agree with you there.
But I'll watch them anyway.
Oh, all right. Well, I will probably miss this one just like I missed Rush Hour 2.
Okay. Well, how about Stardust? Have you heard about that?
No, what is it?
Okay, well, basically, I was seeing the trailer, and you can just picture the guy pitching it to the studio. It's straight out of the beginning of The Player. It'd be like, so it'd be like a Pirates of the Caribbean meets Peter Pan sort of thing, right? Yes, that's pretty much it. Pirates of the Caribbean meets Peter Pan. We got Robert De Niro as a pirate and Michelle Pfeiffer as a snow queen. And I don't know. I'm a sucker for these movies, though. I think fantasy adventures in general, with the pretty visuals and everything, are fun. So, I'm looking forward to this one too. But strange. It's kind of interesting to see how certain genres come into popularity for a short period of time, and everybody's trying to make them. We mentioned the serial killer thing that might be winding down, and now we're going to get the Pirates of the Caribbean remade 10 times for the next 5 years. So, moving on to The Invasion, August 17th. We haven't had enough versions of Invasions of the Body Snatchers, I don't think,
Right.
because we've only had three.
Plus, all the movies loosely inspired on it. I mean, what are you going to do with like the Puppet Masters or stuff that are pretty much like exactly the same movie?
It does feel like if you see one of these versions, it does feel like you've seen it a lot of times before, but it helps to remember that the first one was made in the middle 50s and was one of the few from that time, the few science fiction movies from that time to actually be a great film. And this story, apparently it's well suited to the movies or something, because there was a second really great adaptation of it in the 70s with Donald Sutherland and a lesser known one called The Body Snatchers in 1993. I haven't seen that one. And now we get one called The Invasion. And I'm really looking forward to the 2019 version, just called Of. But Nicole Kidman stars in this. I'll see anything with Kidman in it. That's pretty much my motto. Daniel Craig's in it, the new James Bond. And what do you think? Does this interest you or not?
No, not really. I mean, like again, I feel like I've just seen not just the actual Invasion of the Body Snatchers movies, but there's so many other sci-fi movies that have the same exact premise. Aliens come to Earth, take over humans, or replace them with duplicates, and everything's creepy. I don't know. It just seems like a kind of a one-note thing. I think I've seen it enough times, I don't need to see it anymore.
Yeah, I agree. And I will say that although I'll see anything with Nicole Kidman in it, I would actually rather she had made something else at this time. Well, speaking of remakes, August 31st, Halloween. Because August 31st is Halloween, right? Well, anyway, Rob Zombie remaking Halloween. I think that's a pretty weird idea and kind of pointless. I mean, this is not a story for the ages. It's a story that's only appreciated because it became an icon because the series went on so long and people loved a guy in a mask that went around killing people for some reason. Why were they remaking the story? Why not make Halloween 9, which would be a remake anyway?
Know. I think this. I don't know. I think there's a slight off chance this could be interesting, but probably not. I mean, I'm kind of. I have yet to actually see a Rob Zombie film, but I'm kind of interested too. Devil's Rejects got really strong reviews for that kind of a movie. A lot of mainstream critics really praised it, and it's not a movie that I'm really interested in seeing. But it makes me interested in Zombie as a filmmaker. I don't know. Yeah, but it's probably gonna suck.
Okay, cutting to the chase. Well, our last movie that we'll be talking about also opens on August 31st, and it's another franchise movie, but kind of different. Mr. Bean's Holiday. Mr. Bean, played by Rowan Atkinson, a series of British kind of silent comedies, actually, the 13 episodes of the show, and pretty much he is a silent character. Other people around him talk, he kind of mumbles. But for the most part, his style of comedy goes back to the classic silent comedians. Now, he is updated a bit with a very British sensibility to him, and very he's kind of a child in a man's body, pretty much. But it inspires a lot of love-hate type stuff. People love him. I love him. I'm one of those people. A lot of people don't like him at all. A lot of people who are not British just either don't get the character or think he's just too stupid to appreciate. A lot of British people don't like being represented by him internationally. I don't know. I think the show is hilarious. The movie Bean, there was an earlier movie just called Bean. Bit uneven, bit missed the point, but the good parts are good. I don't know about this one. This one has opened everywhere in the world except the United States at this point, which is pretty unusual. I guess the early word is that it's an improvement on the first movie, but not up to the series. Well, fine, I'll be happy with that, I guess. Do you have any interest in this character?
No, I'm one of those guys who just doesn't get the appeal at all.
Okay. Well, that's fair, and I can certainly imagine that he's a pretty divisive character. Any final thoughts about what this summer looks like overall before we wrap this up?
A lot of threes this year.
Yeah.
It seems like franchises are getting longer. I mean, we have Harry Potter 5 and lots of thirds and trilogies, and I don't know, kind of interesting, I think. And actually, a lot of sequels that don't look so bad. I mean, we were like, we're kind of mocking some of them, but I know I'm going to be at Pirates 3, and we'll definitely both be, I think, at Harry Potter 5, and I'll be at Oceans 3, and I'm trying my best not to go see Spider-Man 3, even though I might. I don't know. I think that's probably a good sign. That some of these, you get like Spider-Man 3, which Sam Raimi is still directing it. That's kind of new that the same director sticks around with
That's true.
like a
That's
comic
very
book
true.
type franchise that long. So, I don't know. I think it looks like a decent summer.
Okay.
Certainly, there have been worse ones, but.
Well, we should probably recap the summer, maybe in September sometime, and so we'll do, kind of do a mirror episode. That'd be a good idea, wouldn't it?
Yeah, that sounds like a very good idea, Sam.
All right. Well, let's make it a tentative plan. Anyway, check out the website, because we're definitely going to open a thread about the summer, and you can tell us all about what you're excited about for the summer. And if we missed anything, maybe, because we did skip a few titles that will be released into theaters over the next few months. So let us know, allmovietalk.com. Last week, we talked about the Looney Tunes and Merry Melodies cartoons made by Warner Brothers from 1930 to 1969. This week and next week, I want to delve down a little deeper and talk about the seven major directors of the cartoons and what distinguishes them. So we'll have sort of like a four-part director spotlight this week. Anyway, the natural place to start is with the director Tex Avery. and not the first director to be hired by the studio, but probably the guy that was most influential in terms of developing the wacky, irreverent style of the Warner Brothers cartoons. In the beginning, it was sort of like all the different cartoon studios sort of felt the same and felt like Disney, really. So Tex Avery gave the Warner Brothers cartoons a bit of an identity that was a bit more off the wall and crazy, edgy. Tex Avery actually started out at the Walter Lantz Studio working on Oswald the Lucky Rabbit, you know, that Disney character before Mickey Mouse. But he worked on that, and then he was hired on to work as a director for Looney Tunes in 1935. And his team included a pair of young animators, Bob Clampett and Chuck Jones, who of course would later become directors themselves. And so he was sort of the mentor to them. And so he was given office space in what would be called Termite Terrace, because, you know, there were termites all through the building, holes in the floor and everything when they moved in. And so it had that affectionate name, that place. Now, Porky Pig was the first Looney Tunes character that we know today. He was created by Bob Clampett before Tex Avery was hired, but Avery is generally credited with making Porky Pig a star. More importantly, though, he's largely credited with introducing the complete, you know, just, as I said, off-the-wall, crazed style, like in Porky's Duck Hunt in 1937. He would introduce the character of Daffy Duck, who was, at least at that time, this out-of-control lunatic that would all bounce around and everything, scream wildly, and drive Porky Pig absolutely bonkers as he tried to shoot him. Well, very much not a realistic type of character, but this was Avery's style. He would do anything for a gag. He wasn't so much interested in these cute, fluffy bunnies or whatever that Disney was animated. He wanted broad gestures and outrageous behavior. He's often quoted as saying, in a cartoon, you can do anything, and you certainly get that impression from his work. The other thing is he loved to play with the medium itself, like breaking the fourth wall by having somebody hold up a sign for the audience to read. It's a pretty common cartoon gag. He started it, and that actually became sort of an unofficial trademark of the Looney Tunes, especially in the Roadrunner cartoons by Chuck Jones later on. But it's a weird idea when you think about it. We sort of take it for granted now. But Avery pioneered this gag, and not just the gag itself, but as I said, the whole approach to cartoons where things like that could happen. And another one is when a character is listening to a radio announcer. The character makes a comment about the broadcast, and the announcer answers the character as if they were having a conversation in the room. This is another trademark gag by Avery and used many times. So anyway, he left the studio in 1941. It was a creative dispute, clashing with the studio over a racy joke. So he left pretty early on in the development of the Looney Tunes, but not before creating the characters of Bugs Bunny and Elmer Fudd in his 1940 cartoon, A Wild Hare. Well, he sort of created them. These characters have nebulous origins. They were based on prototype characters from earlier cartoons by other directors, Happy Rabbit and Egghead, respectively, actually. But this is the first time we see Bugs Bunny's personality come forth and the dynamic he would have with Elmer Fudd for years to come. When Avery left the studio, he went to MGM, and he created Droopy there and made some pretty risque cartoons for the time, and like Red Hot Riding Hood, and eventually returned to the Walter Lantz Studio and created Chilly Willy. So that's Tex Avery in a nutshell and his impact on the Looney Tunes. And he left a lot of inspiration in his wake. A lot of people followed in his footsteps. The second director I wanted to talk about this week is Frank Tashlin, who worked on Looney Tunes at various times from 1932 to 44, just before the end of World War II. Tashlin's influence on the cartoons isn't quite as obvious, but it's pretty cool, because he didn't create any now famous characters, but what he brought to the cartoons was this sense of, he was the filmmaker in the group, a real cinematic sense. He actually wanted to be directing live-action films, and so he used animation as a step toward that end, and the cartoons he made reflect that. They're actually pretty complex in the editing and the camera angles and all that sort of thing, lighting. Of course, lighting is not real lighting. You draw it. But he loved crazy camera angles, Hitchcock and film noir, all that. In the 1943 cartoon Puss in Booty, for example, kind of funny name, it's a Tweety cartoon, but before Sylvester, so it's a different cat. But this really looks like a Hitchcock thriller. I mean, with the dramatic lighting and shadows and camera angles that look down on the birdcage from the rafters and up through the bars and everything. And in Porky's Romance, another cartoon, there's this great scene where Petunia Pig turns Porky away until he sees that he brought not just boring old flowers, but candy. So she speeds out the door in a blur to catch up to him. And watch the editing, if you see this cartoon, this scene in this cartoon. It's lightning fast. I mean, sometimes just a few frames per shot. And that, as much as the motion lines and soundtrack and everything, conveys this impression of exaggerated speed, of real movement and kinetic energy. Things move fast in Tashlin's cartoons. That was another trademark of his. Well, Tashlin eventually did get to move on to live action. First he was writing for Bob Hope and the Marx Brothers, and then he was a director when he was hired to finish up The Lemon Drop Kid in 1951 with Bob Hope. Ultimately, he would direct his own Bob Hope and also Jerry Lewis movies many, many times. And the interesting thing is how his live action comedies still reflect this cartoon sensibility to them. I mean, you can't watch Son of Paleface, for example, or It's Only Money, and not get the sense that are essentially live-action cartoons. So it's sort of an interesting career path to follow. So the next director we'll talk about this week is one many people consider to be the greatest of the Looney Tunes directors, and that his cartoons were the best of the bunch, and that's Bob Clampett. You might have thought I was going to say Chuck Jones. I mean, he's pretty much the other favorite. But these two guys, despite starting out as animators in the same unit under Tex Avery, we're talking about Clampett and Jones now, they sort of represent a fundamentally opposite approaches to cartooning. And we'll get into next week to compare and contrast them. Some people prefer one, some the other. Clampett, I think, is especially popular with other animators. And I think it's probably fair to say that his cartoons were the most animated. You know, everything moves in his cartoons. It's all exciting somehow. Even if it's just one character talking, not a lot of potential for a lot of movement there, it's still bold and energetic and exciting. The Great Piggy Bank Robbery stars Daffy Duck and is sort of this Dick Tracy parody with all the crazy villains and everything. Great example, pretty famous cartoon. There are a few shots of Daffy Duck just talking, and the facial movement is so wild and unhinged. Freeze frame some of that stuff sometime. It'll teach you a lot about how animation works, or maybe teach you how it works in spite of everything you think, because if you look at the individual drawings, they're just weird and distorted and crazy. I mean, they don't look like they'd animate together. They don't look right at all. But then when you animate it together, it's beautiful. I mean, it's a great, real, vibrant, kinetic sort of effect. These distorted drawings make the animation look bold and dramatic and unpredictable. Wonderful stuff, and he was very good at fostering that kind of environment where the animators could do stuff like that. Well, the other thing you'll notice in the animation in Clampett cartoons, though, is the difference in styles from shot to shot. Most cartoon directors exert more control than Clampett did in how their cartoons look. They want to have a cohesive look, and so they, you know, set up the keyframes, and they're pretty inflexible, and they give them to the animators, and they say, you know, I want this to look this way. Well, Clampett freed his animators to be more creative. He was not as protective as some of the other directors over his own keyframes, and that resulted in some pretty great animation work. And also the fact that if you've got a trained eye for it, you can distinguish one animator's work from another's within the same cartoon. A lot of the craziest animation in the Clampett cartoons was done by Rod Scribner, who's great at animating really weird, distorted drawings, and Bill Melendez, too, actually went on to produce and direct the classic Charlie Brown specials in a very different style, but also on Clampett's team of animators was Robert McKimson, who would eventually replace Frank Tashlin as a director of that unit when Tashlin left. Anyway, Bob Clampett was a real protege of Tex Avery, and he built on Avery's sense of humor. If anything, he was more outrageous and violent and weird. A lot of the stuff that gets cut out of cartoons for television airing today was his violent gags, you know, crazy, crazy stuff. I mean, there's nothing wrong with him, but people get uncomfortable about that stuff today. There's a bit in The Great Piggy Bank Robbery where a bunch of villains pile into a doorway and get stuck there in the doorway because they're all trying to chase Daffy Duck at the same time. And Daffy Duck's trapped on the other side, and he gets through by breaking up into a lot of little pieces. And each piece, you know, one arm, one leg, one bill, and everything, they all sort of wriggle through these little gaps independently of each other and then reassemble on the other side. It's just out of the blue. Wild stuff. And why does that happen? How can it? You know, that's the world of cartoons. But he was big on the surreal, too. Dolly being a particular inspiration, especially in Porky in Wacky Land, where Porky Pig visits this crazy place that's kind of like Dolly crossed with Alice in Wonderland, where there's all kinds of inventive sight gags and everything. Anyway, if Tex Avery can be credited with moving the studio away from Disney-esque cartoons, Bob Clampett finished that process, and, you know, his work was just unrelentingly creative and completely nuts, very, very funny, and that's why a lot of people think it's, they were the best of the Looney Tunes cartoons. Unfortunately, he left the studio in 1946, and most of his later work was in television, a bit less successful. But when Clampett left, his animation unit was taken over by a guy named Arthur Davis, who had been one of the animators for the Frank Tashlin unit. Davis's style, you know, unfortunately I don't have too much to say about it. His style was, you know, more reserved than Clampett's, definitely more easygoing. His cartoons have more of a pleasant atmosphere to them rather than manic. But, you know, he wasn't quite as controlled as Chuck Jones that we'll talk about next week. Hard to say too much about him. You know, he wasn't really a groundbreaker, but he was very proficient and competent. He made some very funny cartoons during his short time as director. And, you know, in 1949, 3 years later, Warner had to do some cost-cutting, and so it broke up the Davis unit and dispersed it. Various people went to the different other units, and Davis became an animator again for Friz Freleng. But, you know, his cartoons do hold up, even if he wasn't a groundbreaker. So anyway, that's four of the major seven Looney Tunes directors, and three to go. If you've been listening closely, you already know who they are.
That's it for episode 31. We hope you go out there and check out some great summer movies, and we hope that you hop on our website and let us know what you think of the various summer movies this year. I'm sure that we'll put up reviews as the summer goes on and have discussion areas for all the movies that are coming out recently, and as well as we always like to do at allmovietalk.com. We'll feature discussions of other movies, both classic things and just whatever happens to pop in our head. So if you're interested in the show, be sure and check out the website at allmovietalk.com.
And Rinkworks.com as well. Next week, we'll be back with a regular slate of segments, and just as an example, we'll be talking about 3D in the movies over time. You know, the big 50s explosion of 3D, and now we got something like that going on again. So we'll be talking about the history of that. And our top six list, if you want to play along at home and pick out your own choices before we get to ours, we'll be celebrating Mother's Day, because it'll be the last Tuesday before Mother's Day, with our top six movie moms. So see you next week. Cut. That's a wrap. Go home, get some rest, have a good night's sleep. See you again in 3 hours.